The third case for oral argument this morning is on the matter of the adoption of a child known as DM. For the appellant, proposed interveners is Ms. Deborah Watson, attorney from Rapid City. For one appellee is Ms. Jean Klein, an attorney from Rapid City, who I understand will speak for 15 minutes. Is that correct? Well, we don't chastise for sitting down early, if that's what you're applying, but you have 15 minutes if you choose to use it. And then Ms. Ann Holhauser, who is an assistant attorney general, will speak for 5 minutes, correct? Okay. Ms. Watson, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Associate Justice Sabers, Koningkamp, Center and Meyer Henry, Ms. Klein, Ms. Holzhauser. My name is Deborah Watson. I represent DM's maternal great aunt and uncle, Fay and Kelly Deegan. My argument today is not all that different from my argument before the court last time, and I don't believe the facts really are in dispute. I'd like to begin, however, with a brief recitation of the facts. The parental rights of DM's mother and father were involuntarily terminated by the trial court in an abuse and neglect action. DM was then placed with the Department of Social Services for adoptive placement. The Department of Social Services sought out adoptive families, including my clients, the Deegans, to be an adoptive placement for DM. The Deegans completed all of the requirements of the department, including attending the Pride classes and a positive home study, so they could be an adoptive placement for DM. DSS then, in violation of their own procedures, selected the foster family over the relative placement. The Deegans then moved to intervene in the A&M proceeding. The trial court found that the Deegans had standing, but denied the intervention because of undue delay to DM. The Deegans then appealed to this court, which found that the civil rules of procedure didn't apply in the dispositional phase of an abuse and neglect action. So then this matter proceeded back to the trial court. The judge in the A&N action required that the foster family and the department provide notice to the Deegans of the adoption, so that we then could also move to intervene if we desired to do so, which we did. The Deegans then moved to intervene in the adoption proceeding and were also denied intervention once again, which resulted in this appeal. It is the Deegans' position that they have an intervention as a matter of right under STCL 15-6-24A.
Help me understand the facts a little better. Do the Deegans have a relationship with this child?
Yes, Your Honor, they do. But we never were really able to, we never had any evidentiary hearing, so that never came out. But they had known her since she was 11 months old. I think she was about five at the time.
Knows the Deegans as well?
Pardon?
The child knows the Deegans as well.
She does. Yeah, she'd been had contact with them. In fact, on the Christmas before her rights were terminated, she'd spent Christmas with them in their home. It was a real close-knit family. Unfortunately, the mom was an alcoholic, but the rest of the family. I think the home study was attached to our first brief.
I was just curious because I know that your clients have been fighting this battle for years now.
They have.
Not only in the courts, but in the legislature,
right,
to get the laws changed. So I was just curious to know what was motivating, and it must be this relationship that they...
Yeah, they loved her, and they continue to love her and want her placed with them.
What kind of relief are you seeking then from this court, a second dispositional hearing?
No, Your Honor, what we're asking is that the Deegans be allowed to intervene in the adoption proceeding. Obviously, at this point, the adoption would have to be set aside. We're asking for an evidentiary hearing so that the Deegans could have their day in court and present their evidence to the court so the court can determine what is in DM's best interest in terms of her adoptive placement.
Right.
Now, they would have to object They're objecting to the petition that's currently there, and they would not have a right to petition themselves. That's what the trial court determined.
Right.
And do you agree with that, that they don't have the right at this point to actually petition?
That would be correct.
Because of the requirements that the child live with them for 6 months, I assume. And,
right.
And those kinds of requirements.
Right. Justice Meyer Henry, basically, until DSS places the child with them, and we've never gotten to that point, that's where we're at, is trying to get placement of DM with the Deegans before we can move forward then with the adoption.
I know this is premature, but how are you ever going to be able to win this case if you get the opportunity to have a trial on the merits to show that your clients are the best, would be the best adoptive placements in the best interest of the children?
Well, Justice Sabers, I guess I agree with you that justice delayed in this case can be justice denied, so we do have concerns about the delay and the fact that the department has not allowed any contact with DM's great aunt and uncle during the pendency of the action. We do feel, too, however, that it's never too late to go home with your family. DM, when she was, her rights were terminated to her parents, were old enough to know her family. And I was able to attend a few of the hearings in the abuse and neglect case, albeit was confidential. The judge allowed me to attend some of those hearings, and it was reported by the department that DM was asking about her family. And so I think that the fact that she's had a relationship, she had a relationship with her family longer than she's had a relationship with the foster family. But clearly the fact that she's been with a foster family now for quite some time is a negative. But I don't think it's ever too late to go home.
But let me ask you this then. If you prevail with us on this appeal, then you're going to have to go back and have a hearing. And essentially, you're going to have to litigate the question of the department's decision as to who the best placement should be with. So you're, in essence, going to have to show that they abused their discretion or they did something, and that your family is a better family than the family they chose. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice Center.
But the standard is best interest of the child, isn't it?
It is, and that's the trial court's determination. Our position is that the Deegans have a right to intervene under the statute. There's basically four elements of the intervention statute. One is timely intervention, and as this court knows, I was here probably too early with the ANN, but we did file a motion to intervene within the time that the trial court gave us to make our petition. The second issue, which I think is the one that's really in dispute today, is the legally protectable interest. The third issue is whether that the disposition impedes the ability to protect the interest. And of course, not allowing the Deegans to have an evidentiary hearing on whether it is in DM's best interest to be placed with them would impede their ability to protect their interest in being able to adopt their great niece. The fourth element is whether the interests of the Deegans are represented by other parties, and I think that's pretty clear that the department and the foster parents don't share the Deegans' position and don't represent.
With this decree of adoption having been entered, does that completely cut off any access that these clients of yours would have with this child?
It does.
Shifting back to the legally protected interest, doesn't the passage of Senate Bill 55 during this year's legislature, doesn't that suggest that you did not have that right before the passage of that act? I mean, usually when an act's passed, it suggests it was needed to create some kind of a right. You now have that right under Senate Bill 55, which to me means you didn't have it before it was passed.
Well, Justice Center, we believe that the passage of Senate Bill 55 really just confirmed what the DSS own policies and procedures manual required. We didn't want there to be any dispute as to what the policies and procedures were to be for the Department of Social Services in placing children whose rights had been involuntarily terminated. I'd refer the court to the DSS rules, it's our position that the trial court, in terminating the rights under 26-8827, vested with the Department of Social Services the custody of DM. Then, under the statute and administrative rules, the department then promulgated their own written policies and procedures regarding handling of placement of children whose rights had been terminated.
Now, are these formally promulgated rules done during public hearing, or are these just internal guidelines to employees of DSS?
My understanding, Justice Gilbertson, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, is that they are their internal policies and procedures.
So they would not necessarily then grant rights to the public at large like your clients. It's just advice to their own employees.
We believe that it does create a legally protectable interest in the Deegans because of their internal policies, because they promulgated these rules to be followed. Basically, the legislature referred the custody so they could do an investigation and make a recommendation.
Do you have any case you can cite to where this court has used internal operating rules as compared to publicly enacted rules that you find in the books as supporting your position?
Well, Your Honor, I think probably the case that Justice Saber cited in our last appeal, the Chevron case, which talked about the internal policies, is about as close as we can get. I think that this is a case of first impression. I don't think that this has been heard before. I do believe that under the administrative rules that DSS promulgated these written policies and that they're required to follow them. Basically, what the policies provide is that the order for preference of a permanent family once the rights have been terminated is, number one, a birth family. And birth family is defined in their policies or procedures manual as a father, mother, grandparents, uncles, aunts, and of course the Deegans in this case as a great aunt and uncle would fit within their requirements. The department goes even further in their rules and states that when it's impossible for a child to live with birth family members who may or may not adopt, the department attempts to place a child with a non-related adoptive family. So basically, these are the department's own rules which they have failed to follow in this case. And it's our position that the department's own rules, that they should comply with their own rules, and that these rules do create a legally protectable interest in the Deegans.
Did the trial court address this issue?
It did.
What did it say?
It denied the motion for intervention. There was really no explanation.
Okay, but I guess maybe I should ask my question better. Did the department or did the trial court ever address whether these rules vested rights in your clients that the department was required to follow?
We didn't get any specificity.
Okay.
But I'm assuming in denying our motion to intervene that they basically didn't find any legal protectable interest.
That was just what you got was a general intervention denied in
right.
the subject. Okay.
Right.
Let me ask you.
Wasn't the reason given just untimely? That it would be a burden on the children, on the child, because it'd be untimely?
Well, I think both of the trial court judges, Judge Kern and Judge Davis, both had concerns about the delay, as do we. I mean, delay in any placement of a child is something that's undesirable. But I don't think that the court did not find that we were untimely in making our intervention request.
No, but that to allow a hearing on the merits would take more time, is what I'm talking about.
Right, and I think both the trial judges in this case were concerned about that.
Let me ask you a practical question. If we adopt your position and find that a great aunt and uncle have a legally protected interest in the placement of a child whose parental rights have been terminated, what level of consanguinity do we draw the line where a relative no longer has a legally protected right? Because, as you know, I mean, a family tree extends back forever, essentially. And if we publish an opinion saying that a great-grand uncle has a legally protected right, at what point do we say, no, it's too attenuated, the relationship isn't there any longer?
Well, basically, I just kind of want to walk you through the way the department does their investigation and makes recommendations. Basically, once the rights are terminated, the department then seeks out adoptive families. They look at, actually, they put the word out that they have this child that's available for adoption, and anyone can apply to adopt. And then if they express an interest, then the department requires them to attend the Pride classes and does a home study and decides whether they're approved or disapproved as a placement. Once that's done, then those families who are approved by the department then received an affirmative recommendation, which the Deegans and the foster family and then another relative of DM in this case. So basically, DSS narrowed it down to three. They said these three families meet our requirements. And so, Justice Enger, I think that's where we're at. I mean, I think that a family has to comply with all of the requirements of the department and to do so in a timely fashion before they would have the right to intervene. And of course, they would have to fit within the criteria of family. But they would have to make an application. They would have to complete all the requirements of the Department of Social Services. They'd have to have a positive home study and be approved for the adoption of this particular child.
So they'd have to make the first cut, so to speak.
Yeah, they have to make quite a few cuts, I think, before they get there. Right. They have to be timely in their application and attend Pride classes, positive home study recommended by the department for placement. In this particular case, the department narrowed it down to three families.
Well, then with the other, with the third family that was involved here, who was not a relative, under your analysis, would they have a legally protected interest?
No.
Why is that?
Because under the department's rules, which they promulgated, basically, the order of preference, and I'm looking at their procedures manual, Child Protection Services, says that the order of preferences for a permanent family is the birth family, and then it describes those members of the birth family, and it expands that a little bit to say significant others should be sought out as permanent families who have been identified by the child's family who's been involved with the child.
But they should have the right. They should have the right to litigate that the. That the birth family isn't the right family. I mean, if there's a right to intervene here, it seems to me it should apply to everybody who makes the cut under your analysis, because they should have the right to then litigate, no, the birth family's inappropriate for reasons A, B, C, and D. We're just talking about the right to litigate here, right?
We are. Yeah, all we're asking for is that the Deegans have their day in court and be heard on this issue.
Now, after Senate Bill 55, your right would have been in the dispositional phase, is that correct?
Right. It would be earlier, and that's what we want to do, is do it at...
So you're kind of caught in between the... in limbo here between these two, between our decision and the law, correct?
Well, the law became, you know, codified. Mm-hmm. We believe that the Policies and Procedures Manual created a legally protected right for the Deegans, but you're right. In response, Justice Center, I believe that because of the preference statute, that the family would have a legally protectable right. I guess I'm not willing to take it far enough to say that others would. But you may, you know, you're probably right. I guess those that the department has approved for placement, I guess could argue, but I just don't think that their argument would be as persuasive, because the department says unless it's impossible to place with family, then we look at others. And so we're relying heavily on the department's own internal procedures and policies manual that gives family preference in placement. The cases that have talked about placement and sort of have been appeals involving other situations in abuse and neglect proceedings have been cases where either the litigants or the court has tried to circumvent the department's recommendations and investigation. Cases where they tried to do a guardianship out of court or do a voluntary termination so the children could be placed with someone else. The cases that have been cited in the briefs that are the South Dakota cases basically are all end runs around DSS. That's not our case. The Deegans did absolutely everything that the department required of them. It was the department, in this case, that failed to follow their own internal policies and procedures, and we're asking that this court remand this case back to the trial court to reverse and remand it for an evidentiary hearing so that the Deegans can have their day in court and so that the trial court can determine what adoptive placement is in DM's best interest.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Okay. Ms. Klein, you have 15 minutes.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Ms. Watson, co-counsel. I am Jean Klein, and I represent Susan and Luis Pena. They were the foster family for this child during the pendency of the ANN. They are the adoptive parents of this child now. They are opposing this matter because they believe that the correct decision was made by both courts and that the child is properly placed in the best placement for her. In regards here too, I guess I want to make clear that it is understood that this is an adoption proceeding. This court in December of 2004, in the case in the matter of DM, issued a decision that related to the ANN proceeding. That abuse and neglect proceeding was the proceeding wherein the appellants went to Judge Kern to request the ability to intervene within that action and to seek to have the judge allow them to litigate the matter of whether or not the department had made the correct decision. Just as Ms. Watson temporarily appeared at that, so I appeared as well at least one hearing. Pena's, however, were not part of that matter, did not have the right to take part in that appellate, and so as far as what occurred in the ANN process and the first appeal, they have not voiced any written documents or any oral presentations. What I do note here, though, is that we are here today because the Pena's filed a petition to adopt under 25-6. They did not file under the abuse and neglect statutes. They filed because they had met the statutory obligations. They were each 10 years older than the child. The child had lived with them in excess of 6 months. That they had met all the underlying and the statutorily requirements that are set forth in that section. And that the party which held the right to consent, that being the Department of Social Services, had indicated their willingness to consent to this family adopting. When that occurred, but for Judge Kern's ruling, normally there would have been no notice sent to anyone. The Department of Social Services was instructed to inform Ms. Watson and her clients of when the adoption petition was filed and the hearing was set. And to accommodate that matter, I set it out far enough to meet those requirements, even though the statute itself only requires a 10-day notice provision. When we look at this matter, the question of the rights of the Deegans in regards to challenging the placement that has been made has already been adjudicated. This court, in its majority decision last December, indicated that they did not have a legally, statutorily recognized basis upon which to intervene in the ANN, and that the right to determine the placement was vested with the Department of Social Services. I think, Justice Meyer-Hendry, you're quite correct. Had this case come up a year from now, there is a process that would have been addressed. But that process was not in place. Furthermore, under the prior case law, which have dealt with challenges probably the one that's most consistently close to the challenger being in the matter of ZZ, wherein a grandfather who had had custody and had been contemplated for a guardianship if the court chose not to terminate, in that decision, the Supreme Court stated that with the termination of the parental rights, the rights of the extended family become moot. That, it is my client's position that that position remained in full force and effect throughout this time period. It is still in effect until the law which has created the process for a review of placement, not a review of an adoption, comes into effect, which will be this July. Ms. Watson indicated that there are essentially four bases upon which to review under 15.624. She talks about three of them, the first one being timeliness. I would concur, she timely filed her matter in this adoption proceeding. There's not a question that it was not timely brought to the court. But the second, third, and fourth ones are all hinged on the second one. Is there a legally protected interest here for this family, that being the Deacons? I believe that the prior decision by this court said that they did not have that, and I do not believe that they can resurrect it now, which in truth is not to challenge my client's adoption, but to re-again attempt to challenge the placement decision in the adoption. To do that, it would appear to me that this court must conclude that in the prior decision, that being the decision which most directly impacts the department, and I leave the department to address how they view this, they have been held consistently throughout case law to have the decision-making entity there. In the adoption process, we have three entities who come before a court. We have the child, which we have in this instance. We have the party seeking to adopt the child, that being Susan and Luis Pena. And we have the individual in whom it is vested to make the consent. There is no basis under 25.6 in which a non-member of one of those entities can challenge that adoption. The only challenge that are recognized in that are a challenge without consent, which comes under 25.6.4. And under 25.6.4, that is based on the parent. The most usual situation that would occur in is a situation wherein one parent has remarried, a step-parent wishes to adopt, and the other parent does not wish to consent. That statute, 25.6.4, delineates grounds under which this court, or the trial court, can look and say that it's in the best interest of the child to allow the adoption to occur without the consent of the other parent. The Deacons do not fall within that parameters, therefore they do not fall within the area which defines it as a statutorily protected right. I believe, Judge Zinchers, that you correctly construe the matter of the upcoming law by virtue of the fact that the legislature has now created a specific process and delineated a specific group of people who may challenge, not in an adoption, but in the ANN, that prior to that, such right did not exist. The state has stated in its brief on page 14 a number of cases by other entities wherein in each of those factors, those state courts have said you have to have a statutory basis upon which to permit a declaration of someone as an interested person or upon which someone is declared, as now Senate Bill 55 would be declared, to be able to raise a question to have it reviewed.
Would you comment on Ms. Watson's distinguishment of those cases?
On the cases in South Dakota, I believe the cases in South Dakota more clearly support the position of what the court did in the prior hearing. In the cases which were decided, one which was Baby Boy K, another of which is in the matter of HO, I believe, and a third is in the matter of ZZ, which I've previously talked about. In each of those, you have a different family member attempting to do something different. For example, in one case, they attempted to voluntarily terminate their right during the ANN so that they could choose who to place the child with. In another, a determination was made subsequent, prior to a paternity establishment and subsequent to a placement, that a father wanted to come forth, a putative father, and challenge. In ZZ, it was a grandfather who had obviously been deeply involved with the child, who wanted to challenge the decision making. In each of those cases, without reaching the issues which this court is looking at today, which is, do we have a legally recognized interest for intervention? Nonetheless, this Supreme Court has consistently said that the decision making in that matter, when the parents' rights are terminated, belongs to the Department of Social Services and does not create any basis upon which one could extrapolate that there are any rights left to extended family members. We now have that further enumerated by the fact that Senate Bill 55 has created a specific process or procedure wherein they may, within the ANN, have a specific review done of that placement. But again, that review only relates to if the placement is to a non-member family. If it's two family members and the DSS picks one family member, there is still no review. For example, if the Deegans were to say, I think I'm better than my cousins at receiving this child, they still could not come forth. All we've done, or all the legislator has done, is said, we will now allow a review if you place outside the family, which is somewhat consistent to the Indian Child Welfare Act, a good cause to the contrary, requiring some type of showing that would occur there. I did want to indicate on some factual matters. Ms. Watson had indicated that the Deegans were not permitted contact. That's not totally true. During the pendency of this first appeal, they were permitted to write letters. In regards to the Chevron decision, I believe that to DSS, I not enough on their internal regulations to feel comfortable to respond to that, Your Honor. In the present matter,
let me ask you this question then. In this case, if we were to agree that there is no standing or agree and affirm it, that which is, I think, interesting because you say once this court signs the order terminating parental rights, there are no relatives.
That's any
rights because that's been determined in those parental rights or those rights to, that the relatives might have are really terminated at the time that order is signed.
I think we need to look at it in the terms of the ability to come to a court and litigate that matter. Yes, they are terminated.
Okay, then in this case, because of the prior decision and prior to Senate Bill 55, there's never been an opportunity or we've shut the door for allowing any court to review either the ANN court or the adoption court to review whether it's in the child's best interest to be placed for adoption with your clients as opposed to a relative.
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor. Under the ANN provisions, the trial court keeps continuing jurisdiction. That is the statute upon which Ms. Watson, I think, relied somewhat in her arguments in the first go-round, was that there was a continuing jurisdiction statute there. And indeed, the hearing that occurred prior to their appeal was a six-month review hearing that occurs under those statutes. In that matter, it's my position that a judge who is handling an ANN may ask for any information it wishes if it feels there's a need to review. In the present case, in the ANN, not only did the department confirm that they felt the placement chosen with my clients was the best, but Todd Schweigert, who was the child's attorney, affirmed that, and the CASA, who had been appointed to the case, appeared and confirmed that. The fact of the matter is that the court could have whatever parameters of review it wanted. The question that Ms. Watson wants is to enable someone to come in and litigate that. I don't think that it's just a slam dunk. If the court has any concerns in an ANN, it is free to ask for whatever further information it wants. In an adoption, I've never had an adoption in my almost 25 years of practice with this type of parameters. I have done adoptions in which a parent has refused to consent, and the court has permitted that person, because they have a legal protective right, to participate and to litigate. Beyond that, the court has taken the reports, if both, whether it's from the Department of Social Services who's consenting, a private agency such as Catholic Social Services who is appearing, or if it's a private step-parent adoption and it has a signed affidavit from the other parent. It accepts that, but again, under, I believe it's 25611, the court has the right, if it has a concern, to question. What Ms. Watson wants is the right to litigate it, to bring forth those people who are not pleased with the decision that was made, to litigate it. I do not doubt in any fashion that the Deegans feel the grievance. This is a lovely little girl. And unlike many, she has had more than one family who wishes her to live with them. But the law, when it talks about a legal permissible right, talks not about what the issues are and will you win or lose. The issue under intervention is, can you establish that legally permissible right to intervene? There is no statutory authority under the adoption laws which would permit this, and I have seen no statutory authority cited by the appellants that come from any other source that which would permit it. Therefore, I would ask that you deny the request.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. Ms. Wolfhauser, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justices, counsel, good morning. My name is Ann Holzhauser. Again, I represent the Department of Social Services. As you may recall, I was before you approximately a year and a half ago, wherein we talked about many of the arguments that are being raised today, and I would reiterate Ms. Watson's statement to that effect. I would suggest to you that the fact that we are here a year and a half later, and the fact that we could be here again a year and a half later, if the Deegans are allowed to intervene in this matter, speaks mountains in favor of denying their request to intervene. As the court noted in its earlier decision, in the DM decision following our earlier oral argument, the Deegans did not have a right to intervene in the A&N proceeding. There was no right to intervene under the statute. There was no legal right aside from any statutory provision, and it wasn't in the best interest of the child, or at least that's what the trial court had found. We're now in a separate proceeding in the legal sense, but I suggest to you that this is actually a continuation in many ways of the A&N proceeding. The department is acting within the authority that it was granted in the A&N proceeding by making a placement decision, and if I could, I'd explain a little bit about how that process was made. The department, as Ms. Watson has said, contacts relatives, finds out who's interested, might be interested in adopting the child, asks those relatives to go through the process which any other family would be required to undergo if they were to adopt a child. That's the pride class, that's the home study class. Once the department determines whether or not a relative or a non-relative is approved to adopt a child, the department gathers the information together, looks at what the needs of the child are, and what the ability of those individuals are to meet those needs, and based upon that information, makes a decision regarding the placement decision. So in other words, just because a relative or non-relative is approved for adoption doesn't mean that they're approved to adopt the child in question. Because
so they can violate their own internal rules, even though they've not established that it was impossible to place with a birth family?
Your Honor, I would agree that those internal rules are perhaps not artfully drafted in the sense that it uses the term impossible, but I would also suggest that the department is required to act in the best interest of the child at all times.
But we've never had a ruling on that yet. as to whether or not it's in the best interest of the child.
I think that, Your Honor, I think Judge Kern, when this issue first came up in the ANN proceeding, she asked to see the home studies from all of the, from the three families in question. She asked to see the psychological evaluation that was done. She was provided a copy of the letter from the child's therapist. She also questioned the worker as far as what was the procedure that was followed in terms of making this placement decision. And the worker explained the procedure, that the home studies were reviewed, that a conference call was held. Who was present during that conference call? That would be people from the local office as well as people from other offices and the therapist, I believe, and how they came to the decision that placement with the foster family for an adoption was in the best interest of the child. Judge Kern reviewed that, and I think that absent some evidence to say that the department's decision was contrary to the best interest of the child, I think Judge Kern acted appropriately and gave due deference to the department's placement decision. That's not to say that the court wasn't finding that it was in the best interest of the child. I think it's a question of what evidence or what information does the court need to make that finding, given the history.
And of course, it's in the absence of any evidence on the part of the Dagans to counteract what you've supplied there.
Well, that assumes that the Dagans would have a right, and that's the issue that we're is key this morning, whether the Dagans would have a right to present that evidence. I think the court could have, if it chose to do so, could have asked for additional information, could have possibly asked that the Dagans be brought forward so that the court could question the Dagans. I think the court would have had that ability to do that, or the child's attorney.
In the A&M proceeding.
In the A&M proceeding. But not allow them to intervene, because by allowing them to intervene, as Ms. Klein has mentioned, that allows them to litigate whether or not just whether the department's selection of the foster family was in furtherance of the child's best interest, but whether or not they're better. Okay, so questioning not just the propriety of the department's decision, but whether or not a better decision could have been made. And I think that that goes beyond what this court has recognized to be the department's role in placement decisions, even in the In Re DM case.
Your time has expired. Thank you. Ms. Watson, you have 10 minutes.
This is an important decision for DM, because what we're asking the trial court to do is to make the best decision for her in terms of her adoptive placement. The Deegans in this case were deprived of any evidentiary hearing. So basically all the trial court heard was the evidence that was presented through the department by the Pinas. So they've never really had their day in court. Basically under the statute, it grants the department the right to investigate, to recommend, and to consent. In order to do that, they promulgated their own rules under the administrative rules. Those rules provided that they would give preference to family. Deegans fit into that. Basically, the final decision, however, I believe rests with the trial court, because the department investigates, recommends, and consents. But the trial court's not a rubber stamp. The trial court needs to hear if there's a challenge, and we've even got foster kids who nobody wants. How sad is that? Fortunately for DM, there were lots of people who loved her and wanted to parent her.
Ms. Watson, you raise a number of excellent policy issues. My question is, what's the source of the legal authority that gives your clients a legally protected right?
Okay, our position is that under the statute, which is 26-8-8-27, the court vests the Department of Social Services with the custody of DM. Then the department promulgates their procedures manual to set forth the rules that they're going to abide by in placing this child for adoption. So it's our position that those procedures under the Administrative Procedures Act that the department implemented give rise to a legally protectable interest in the Deegans.
But I thought you conceded the first time you were up here that they never promulgated these as official rules that went into the code books, that these are merely internal operating rules. And there's a big difference in my mind.
And my understanding is they are internal. I could be wrong. I don't know. These were the rules that we were provided. My understanding, Justice Gilbertson, is that they are their internal policies, that they promulgated these in furtherance of the statute under what their duties are in terms of the investigation, recommendation, and consent. I wanted to briefly go over, and this makes it difficult because it is a case of first impression, and as Justice Meyer Henry indicated, we're sort of in the crack here between the dispositional and the adoptive proceeding. But I'd like to just kind of walk you through some of the cases that are the most similar to the fact scenario presented to the court today. One of the cases was the matter of THM. In that case, the grandmother tried to circumvent DSS through a guardianship. So that's entirely different than what happened here. Basically, DSS was the one who tried to circumvent their rules. The Deegans complied with everything that they were required to do. And as Ms. Holzhauser indicated, the fact that the Deegans are here does speak loudly, but for a different reason. They love DM and want her to remain as part of their family and to raise her as their own child. Another case is the interest of HO. And in that case, the parents attempted to do a voluntary termination to circumvent DSS and transfer custody of the child to the aunt and uncle. And again, this court says you can't do that. You have to follow DSS's rules, which the Deegans did. Matter of JH, that was a situation where basically they tried to, again, circumvent DSS and place the child with the grandmother. And I think in that case, the court dismissed the abuse and neglect and tried to go around DSS and place the child with someone else. Matter of baby boy K, that was a situation where the dad challenged the ANN, and this court found that through his own inaction, he lost standing. And then finally, the matter of ZZ, and that was the one that was raised by Ms. Klein, but that was a situation where a grandfather requested that he be a permanent guardian. And again, from the record that I have, I don't think he was ever approved by the department. In the decision, it appears that the department had concerns about the grandfather, so I'm suspecting he didn't go through the pride classes and get approved because he and the grandmother had had some marital issues. The grandfather felt that his daughter, in this case, hadn't done anything wrong, so the department was concerned about contact with her. So as you can see, all of the cases that we have are situations where either the litigants or the court tried to get around the department. It's our position that this is just the opposite case, and that's why this should be reversed and remanded, is that the Deegans did absolutely everything that the department required. They didn't try to circumvent any of their rules, and they complied fully with them, gave timely notice, moved to intervene, and provided to the court, but the court never got an opportunity to hear the home study that was done. So so basically what we're asking is that you reverse and remand, that the Deegans do have their day in court. If they're not allowed to have their day in court, basically, why do we have trial courts involved in adoptions? Because it's just rubber stamps. In involuntary terminations, the trial court's decision. I mean, in all the years that I've been handling adoptions, I've never seen a case where the trial court has said no to the department. So if someone who's gone through and been recommended for placement by the department is not allowed to have an evidentiary hearing, then basically all the trial court is a rubber stamp for the department, and that's not right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.